When they reach the edge of the woods, they must move more carefully, looking for signs that someone has passed this way. Sorensen remembers other searches in woods like these, looking for lost hunters, sometimes for lost children. Occasionally, searches end happily. She's under no illusions about this one. A woman alone, not dressed for the elements. It wouldn't have been long before hypothermia set in. Unless she knew something about how to survive alone in the winter woods, and Sorensen doubts that. To make matters worse, Riley was in a panic, not thinking clearly, and the first rule of survival is to not panic. The branches snap beneath her boots, and the cold, sharp air makes her chest feel tight. She scans the forest, always aware of Lachlan's carefully moving presence to her left. She usually loves walking in the woods, but not today. Along with the urgency she always feels with a ground search, the simultaneous hope and fear, she knows that there might be a killer here somewhere. When they've been at it for a while and Sorensen is really starting to feel the cold, they enter a little clearing where the snow is deeper. She lifts her eyes across the clearing for signs of human trespass, noticing nothing. But then Lachlan calls, "Over here!" Just from the tone of his voice, she knows. Nevertheless, she hastens over to him as fast as she can, clumsy in the deep snow. Lachlan is standing over something darker against the white, a shape huddled up against a large boulder. As she comes closer, she sees that it's a woman, approximately 30. Face an eerie white, lips blue, eyes open but crusted in ice. She's dressed in jeans and a gray sweater, running shoes, no coat, no hat. She's crouched up against the boulder, stiff as a board, her knees to her chest and her arms around them, as if hiding or waiting for something inevitable. Her hands are tucked into her sleeves. It almost breaks Sorensen's heart, but she's careful not to show it. Instead, she bends forward to examine her more closely. There are no visible signs of violence. She pulls back again. "Shit," Lachlan mutters. Crows gather and fly overhead, dark against the pale sky, and Sorensen watches them for a moment. "No signs of trauma," Sorensen says finally, glancing at Lachlan. "But who was she running from?" Lachlan says, shaking his head. "Out here without a coat." "I don't think she even knew." Chapter 32. Sunday, 10:05 a.m. Sorensen and Lachlan return to the hotel and deliver the bad news. Sorensen doesn't think anyone expected Riley to still be alive, but it is difficult nonetheless. Predictably, her friend Gwen takes it the hardest. She sobs loudly and begins to rock, wailing uncontrollably. Sorensen sits beside Gwen, a hand on her shoulder until she calms down. Finally, she and Lachlan leave the group and go to the privacy of the dining room, where Perez and Wilcox soon report that they are certain there is no one else in the hotel other than the people they know about. There are no signs of anyone having left. They tell her about the broken window and the branch, but they feel the branch likely broke the window on its own. Which means, Sorensen realizes, that it is highly likely that one of the people here is a murderer. For now, each one of them is a suspect. "I'd better caution all of them," she says to Lachlan, "to be safe." Sorensen's first interview is with the hotel owner, James Harwood. She calls him into the dining room, where she has set up an interview table. Some of the warmth from the kitchen filters through. It's taking a while for the heating to come back up. The shutters have been opened so that the room is filled with daylight. In the natural light, James looks terrible. She wonders how he will be able to go on without Bradley. He sits down in front of her. Beside her, Lachlan has his notebook out. She advises James of his rights, and he indicates that he is willing to proceed. She begins gently, "James, I'm so sorry about Bradley." He nods, his lips firmly together in a deep frown, fighting back tears. She knows he's no stranger to misfortune. His wife died of cancer some years back, and he's raised Bradley these last few years on his own. He's had his struggles with Bradley. She leans forward a little and says, "This might be difficult to talk about, James, but you know I've known you and Bradley for a long time." He looks up at her with red-rimmed eyes. "You know I liked Bradley." He nods.
"You've been good to us," he says, his voice a broken whisper.
"So, don't take this the wrong way." He hunches his shoulders warily, as if he knows what's coming. Of course he knows what's coming. She's certain he's had these same questions himself, especially since Bradley was killed. "Is there any way Bradley could have been involved with this situation?" She looks at him intently, with compassion. He looks back at her tearfully. He takes his time answering.
"Bradley was a lot of things, but he would never be involved in something like this," James says, his lips trembling. "He had his problems. You know that. You know what he was like. He was impulsive. He liked excitement. He thought he was invincible. Driving too fast, running with the wrong crowd, the drugs."
He sighs heavily.
"He liked money and what it could buy. He didn't want to have to work too hard for it, and he didn't always know when he was crossing the line.
But he was a good kid." His eyes flood with tears.
"He wouldn't do anything really bad," James says.
"James, I don't mean to suggest that Bradley could have had a hand in these killings," she says. "But perhaps he stuck his nose in. Perhaps he knew something. Something that got him killed."
"I've wondered that,"
James says at last, exhaling heavily. "He had this look that I recognized. The look he had that time he got caught dealing drugs. Remember?
He was always so cocky. But he knew when he was in over his head. That's the way he looked after we found Candace's body."
He shakes his head.
"And I thought he looked tired, like he hadn't slept that night, the night Dana went down the stairs."
He looks up at her.
"What if he saw something? What if he saw who did it?"
"Did you ask him about it?" Sorensen asks. James nods, tears running freely down his face now. He wipes them away. "What did he say?"
"He said he was just freaked out about the murders, like everybody else."
He looks down.
"I didn't push it."
She puts her hand on his shoulder. "James, I doubt there was anything you could have done to make things turn out differently."
He sniffs loudly. "Maybe if I'd tried harder to talk to him, I should have. And now he's dead."
She lets him cry, her hand resting on his shoulder. Finally, he wipes his eyes and blows his nose. He looks up at her and says,
"Room 302, with the unmade bed."
"Yes?"
"There's no way that room was missed," he says. "There's no way it wasn't made up properly after the last guest left. That has never happened before. And once you can talk to Susan, the housekeeper, I think you will find that she says the same thing."
"So what do you think?"
"I don't think there's anyone in the hotel we don't know about. I never did. I know this hotel like the back of my hand. If there was someone else here, I think I'd sense it somehow. Or Bradley certainly would have. And he was certain there was no one else here. Maybe he knew who the killer was."
He chokes back a sob.
"I think that one of the guests is the killer,
And whoever it is got into that room and messed it up to make us think there was someone else in the hotel. Bradley thought so, too. He told me. He looks at her harshly. One of them killed my boy. She's already come to that conclusion herself. Thank you, James. She looks at him sympathetically as she stands up. We'll find out who did this. She dismisses James and calls in David Paley next. Sergeant, David Paley says courteously to her as he takes the seat across from her and Officer Lachlan. Can I get you anything? Water? She asks. David shakes his head. I'm fine. She's pretty certain he is the same David Paley who was charged and released a few years back in the murder of his wife. She remembers the case. It remains unsolved. She's not going to ask him. Yet. She has already had his brief account of what happened. Now, after cautioning him, she leads him through all of it again, each painful step, each awful detail. Had you ever met Dana Hart or Candace White before this weekend? No, never. Ever heard of them? He shakes his head. No. Ever met anyone else who was here this weekend? No. Finally, she tilts her head at him and asks, What do you do for a living? I'm an attorney. So, it is him. Who do you think committed the murders in this hotel? He hesitates and then says, I don't know. She remains silent, waiting for him to continue. The others, Beverly and Henry and Matthew, especially Henry, seemed convinced last night that it was Ian. They were looking at him as if they thought he was going to murder us all. He rubs his eyes tiredly before going on. Perhaps it was relief at finally having someone to blame. They desperately needed to know who it was, and they thought they did. He looks up at her. In my experience, the human mind doesn't like to deal with uncertainty. He tells her then what he hadn't told her before, the way they turned on Ian. Jesus, she says, imagining it. They calmed down. I'll never forget how relieved Ian looked. You may have saved his life. I don't think it would have actually come to that. He shrugs and looks up at her cynically. But that's me, protector and defender of the accused, no matter how heinous the crime. Next, Sergeant Sorensen invites Beverly Sullivan into the dining room. Officer Lachlan, who has an excellent bedside manner, sympathetically offers the bereaved woman a glass of water. She accepts it, takes a sip. Mrs. Sullivan, she begins, having advised her of her rights. May I call you Beverly? Beverly nods. I'm so sorry about your husband. Thank you, she says quietly, tears pooling in her eyes. Lachlan delicately pushes a box of tissues toward her. He'd found them in the kitchen. We don't know the cause of death yet. It looks like he died of natural causes, but there will have to be a post-mortem. Beverly nods, wiping fiercely at her eyes with a tissue. I know this must be very difficult, Sorensen says, but I'm sure you understand that I must speak to everyone who was here this weekend to try to determine exactly what happened and why. Beverly nods again, blows her nose. Of course. She asks Beverly to give her account of what happened over the course of the weekend. When she gets to the part about bringing Bradley's body into the lobby, Beverly leans forward slightly and says, Something odd happened then. What do you mean? Sorensen asks. She knows what's coming. She has already heard about this from David. Beverly looks at her for a moment and then explains. It was Ian. He was looking at Bradley. She hesitates, as if unsure how to describe it. How was he looking at him? He had this look on his face, but only for a moment. It was there, and then it was gone.
but it gave me the creeps. I didn't trust him after that. I whispered to my husband that I thought Ian was the killer, right after I'd seen that look on his face. She sits back again in her chair. Henry hadn't seen it. Then, when Lauren told the truth, that she'd been shielding him, that he hadn't been with her all afternoon. "Go on," she says, when Beverly stops. When Lauren said she'd been covering up for him, it all began to make sense. He denied it, of course. He was desperate that we believe him. The situation was indescribable. And what did you think? I know what I saw. I think Ian is the killer, although he was doing a convincing job of denying it. But he's probably a good actor. She leans forward intently and says, all those years he lied to his parents about his little brother. Who could do that? He must be a psychopath. She stops, takes a deep breath. I've never met a psychopath before. I was terrified of him then. We all were. Sorensen interviews Gwen next. She is obviously deeply traumatized by what's happened and very distraught over the death of her friend. When Gwen has given her account of what happened, she asks, so Riley wasn't murdered? She died of exposure? Sorensen says, we won't know for sure till the team gets here, but that's what it looks like. So she didn't have to die at all, Gwen whispers. Sorensen comforts her as best she can. When she finally sends Gwen back out to the lobby, Sorensen feels slightly overwhelmed for a moment by the situation she finds herself in, but she thrusts the feeling aside and refocuses on the job in front of her. When Sorensen calls in Matthew Hutchinson for questioning, she watches him get up stiffly from his chair and make his way to the dining room. Normally, they would separate witnesses into different rooms, but it's easier to have them stick around the fire. She relies on the vigilance of her officers, Perez and Wilcox, to make sure they don't talk among themselves. After advising him of his rights, Sorensen takes her time going through what happened over the weekend with Matthew. She can tell how upset he is. His fiancée is dead, but he answers all of her questions willingly. He has nothing to say that contradicts what the others have told her. She asks, you had no reason to kill your fiancé? What? He looks wary now, afraid. Beverly says she heard you arguing earlier that night. Tell me about that. He drops his head, but he doesn't deny it. She thought he might. It's only Beverly's word against his. Yes, we did argue that night, but it was nothing serious. Just a bit of tension. Wedding jitters, you know. She was finding it stressful. She was finding what stressful exactly? The wedding preparations. Dealing with my family. They can be a bit difficult. Intimidating. Your family wasn't happy about the wedding? I wouldn't say that exactly. He looks away. My mother wasn't 100% on board, but I loved Dana, and she knew I was going to marry her. Okay. I didn't kill her, or anybody else, he says truculently. But you could have. What? You could have committed all of the murders. There is no one who can swear to being with you when any of the victims were killed. Why the hell would I do that? I don't know. You tell me. He stares at her in dismay. Why would your fiancé have left your room in the middle of the night? I don't know. You admit you had an argument. You didn't go after her and, perhaps, in a moment of anger, push her down the stairs? And then, in for a penny, in for a pound, when you saw that she wasn't dead, you didn't grit your teeth and smash her head against the bottom step? She knows she's being rather harsh,
She wants to see how he'll react.
God, no!
He looks appalled.
I didn't kill her.
And then perhaps someone here knew. Maybe someone found out. Maybe Candace knew what you'd done, or suspected it at least. Or maybe Bradley saw something.
Did one of them try to blackmail you? Were they both trying to blackmail you? No, that's outrageous,
he manages to sputter. Is it?
Of course it is. I didn't kill my fiancé. I loved her.
She gives him a long, thoughtful look. He looks back at her, uneasy. Candace was writing a book. Was that book about you? Or about Dana, perhaps? Something that would be damaging?
No, I'd never heard of her. We didn't know anything about a book, and Dana and I have nothing to hide. Why would anyone write a book about us?
She waits, lets him squirm. Okay, that's all for now. She gets up and opens the glass dining room doors. You may go back to the lobby. Chapter 33, Sunday, 12:45 p.m. Sergeant Sorensen returns Matthew to the lobby and asks for Lauren. She watches Lauren rise and walk past her into the dining room. Lauren takes her seat at the table. Sorensen sits down across from her, cautions her, and they begin. Sorensen gives her a small smile. You okay? She asks. Lauren nods. I guess so, considering. She accepts a glass of water from Officer Lachlan and takes a sip. She adds, it will probably all hit me later. Sorensen nods. Shock. Lauren nods back. She seems tense. They have all been tense. You discovered Dana? Yes. I went down early to see if I could find some coffee. I didn't even know if anyone would be up yet. She says, go on. When I got to the landing, I saw Dana lying at the bottom. She glances at Lachlan as if embarrassed. I'm afraid I screamed. I could tell she was dead. She was so still. I ran down to her and then the others came. Did you touch her at all? Yes, I did. I felt for a pulse. She hesitates before going on. Then the others arrived. We were all very upset. You don't expect something like that to happen. We thought she'd fallen down the stairs. And then David said he thought it wasn't an accident. When did he say that? It was after lunch. He said that she had to stay where she was until the police came, that it might be a crime scene. Lauren looks up at her. I don't think anyone believed him at first. We thought it was an accident, that he was overreacting, until Candace was killed. Sorensen has her go through the rest of the day, the discovery of Candace's body, what happened that night. When Lauren is finished, Sorensen says, some of the others think that it might have been your boyfriend, Ian, who was committing the murders. I don't know, Lauren says tightly, looking down at the table. Do you think it's possible? She hesitates before she answers. It's possible. Lauren looks up at her, clearly uncomfortable. I spent some time in the afternoon in the sitting room on the third floor, reading. I wasn't with him. I suppose he could have done it. She looks back down at the table. What about you? Yourself? Sorensen asks. Pardon? You could have killed Candace yourself. You don't have an alibi either. You were alone in the sitting room. For that matter, you could have killed Dana. And later, you could have killed Bradley.
Oh, well, I can assure you that I didn't. What possible reason could I have had?
I don't know. Had you ever met Dana Hart or Candace White before?
Lauren answers firmly, no, of course not. When Sorensen says nothing, Lauren leans forward earnestly.
You have no idea what it was like being trapped here with all this going on. Last night, when everyone ran off into the dark, David running after Matthew, the rest of us running outside after Riley? She shakes her head, as if in disbelief that it ever happened. It was so dark. You couldn't tell where anybody was. But then I heard Gwen. She must have been nearby. I could hear her breathing, sliding on the ice. She sounded like she was panicking, as if she thought someone was after her. Lauren pauses, as if reliving the memory of those awful moments when everything was falling apart. She whispers, "I heard her calling my name, but I didn't answer. I thought maybe if the killer was there, he would follow her instead of me. So I kept very quiet." A sob escapes from her throat, and then she is crying in earnest. Sorensen gives her time to recover. She's patient. She offers the box of tissues. Officer Lachlan waits, his pen poised above his notebook. Finally, Lauren says, "I'm not proud of that." She looks up at her. "But I certainly didn't kill anybody." She reaches for a drink of water. Sorensen notes that Lauren's hand is shaking as she brings the glass to her lips. "Take your time," she says. Lauren continues, "I've been trying to think of signs that I might have missed, signs that Ian might be insane, but honestly, there weren't any." She stares across the table at Sorensen with dark, disbelieving eyes. "He seemed completely normal to me. He charmed everyone. He was so likable. People warmed to him, just like I did. It's so unnerving to think that you might be so wrong about someone, so taken in. I certainly never saw any cruelty in him. I thought that he was someone I could become serious about." "True psychopaths can be very convincing," Sorensen says. Lauren looks back at her, her face bleak. "I don't think you have any idea how frightening it was, sitting in that room all night, knowing there was a murderer somewhere nearby, waiting to see what was going to happen next." "I can't imagine," Sorensen says. As Lauren is leaving, Officer Perez taps at the dining room door. Sorensen turns and asks, "What is it?" Perez enters the room and speaks to her in a low voice. "I just remembered something. It might be important." She nods. "You wanted to know if I or Wilcox had ever heard of the author Candace White. I thought the name sounded familiar, but I couldn't place it. I thought maybe it was someone my wife read. She reads a lot of books." Sorensen nods her head again impatiently. "Yes, but actually, I've read one of her books. She wrote a true crime book a few years ago that I quite enjoyed. That's pretty much all I read."
"Is that so?" Sorensen says. "What was it called?"
"I don't remember exactly, but it was about that school principal who murdered one of his students."
Perez leaves the dining room, and Sorensen glances at Lachlan, who is pursing his lips at this new information. She rubs her hands together and walks to the dining room windows to look out at the forest. She thinks about what might be hiding in that dark wood. Bears, wolves, things that kill. She thinks about the human killer she has in this very hotel. She hears someone enter the dining room. She turns away from the window and sees James carrying a tray with coffee and sandwiches. The sight of James doing what Bradley would normally do almost breaks her heart. It must be lunchtime already. She wants to say thank you, but doesn't trust her voice. He places the tray on the side buffet table, nods, and leaves the room. She walks over and pours a cup of steaming coffee. Then she takes a sandwich and her cup, goes back to the window, and looks out thoughtfully at the forest. David has returned to the dining room, summoned again by Sergeant Sorensen. He wonders wearily what she wants with him. He's told her everything he knows. What he wants right now is sleep.
Mr. Paley, Sorensen says after a long pause. Her voice has changed. It's not quite as friendly as before, and his body tightens automatically, as if expecting a blow. I know who you are. The blow is delivered, exactly the one he was expecting. I've told you who I am, he answers coldly. She nods. You gave me your name, yes. You didn't tell me everything, did you?
Why would I, when it's not relevant?
Perhaps it is relevant, she says.
I don't see how.
Candace White was writing a book.
Yes, David admits. That's what she said.
Do you know what it was about?
I have no idea,
he says, feeling uneasy. She didn't say. He adds, none of us had ever heard of her. He feels his heart sink. Here it comes, he thinks. You are still under suspicion for the murder of your wife, are you not?
No.
That's not exactly true, is it? She prods. He looks at her angrily.
I don't know what you expect me to say. I was arrested, and the charges were dropped, as I'm sure you know. There was insufficient evidence to proceed. As far as I'm concerned, that's the end of it. I don't consider myself under investigation any longer.
Oh, but you are, of course. These investigations don't just stop, do they? Just because they don't have enough to nail you now doesn't mean they won't have enough to nail you down the road. She pauses. A good police officer never gives up. You must know that. They just go about it more quietly.
What's your point? He asks angrily.
I'm just wondering if you might have been in mortal fear of someone writing a book about you, and what Candace might have had to say about the murder of your wife.
That's ridiculous. I told you, I'd never heard of her. She wasn't writing a book about me.
His head feels light, and his heart is beating far too quickly. He knows he didn't murder Candace, or anyone else. She's barking up the wrong tree. I hope not, she adds. But it's been brought to my attention that Candace White is known for writing true crime books. David feels himself go pale. In any case, it's just a matter of time until we get into her laptop, and then we will see, she says. That's all for now. You may go. Chapter 34, Sunday, 1:45 p.m. Sergeant Sorensen sits back heavily. She doesn't know how much longer it will be until the crime team gets here. She looks impatiently at her watch. After spending hours in chilly rooms, drinking endless hot coffee, she's starting to appreciate what it must have been like to be trapped in this godforsaken hotel for the weekend with no power. She can't even imagine the rest of it. But the evidence is there. At least three people have been murdered. Another has probably died from exposure, having fled the hotel in terror. And a fifth has died under suspicious circumstances. The survivors are clearly traumatized. She calls in Ian Beaton, the one they're afraid of, the one some of them seem to think might be the killer. Ian appears pale and apprehensive as he enters the dining room. He regards her warily. She wonders what he thinks is worse, being accused by the others in the middle of the night when their fear and paranoia were at their greatest, or being questioned by the police in the cold light of day. He must be under the most terrific strain, she thinks. She says, please have a seat. He sits down and looks at her as if he's expecting to be arrested. She wonders if he will be the first one to refuse to talk to her after she cautions him. But he nods assent and glances nervously toward the lobby where the others are gathered. The glass doors are closed. Haltingly, guided by her questions, he gives his own account of the weekend. He denies ever having met or heard of Dana Hart or Candace White. He tells her he's as shocked by the murders as everyone else. The others think you did it, she says.
They're crazy.
I didn't kill anyone, he says defensively. It could have been any of them.
Who do you think did it?
He's silent for a moment, and then says,
I don't know.
She raises her eyebrows deliberately. No idea at all?
I'm not a detective, he says stubbornly. But whoever did it must be crazy. This whole situation is crazy.
He licks his lips nervously.
Honestly, last night, I was scared for my life. If it wasn't for David, if it hadn't been for him, they might have murdered me. That asshole Henry suggested it. David managed to calm him down.
She looks back at him impassively. And now Henry is dead, too. He looks up.
I had nothing to do with that either, I swear.
We don't know how he died yet, she tells him. There will be an autopsy, of course. That's all for now. You may go back to the lobby. Sunday, 3:30 p.m. Sergeant Sorensen and Officer Lachlan move to the first floor sitting room, where James has made them a fire. It's more comfortable than the dining room. The others remain in the lobby, under the watchful eyes of Wilcox and Perez. Perez reports that they've been fed but are getting restless. Sorensen knows there isn't much she can do about that. She's feeling impatient, too. The police chief, the medical examiner, the forensics team, and the detectives will get here when the roads are navigable, and not before. She has looked at the physical evidence as best she can herself. Until the forensic crew arrives, there is not much more she can do on that front. She has interviewed everyone present as far as she dared without them all clamming up and starting to ask for legal counsel. She's not happy about being in this remote hotel without the techs to quickly and expertly secure the evidence the way it should be secured. She wishes they would hurry the hell up clearing the roads. There's nothing to do but watch her charges, keep them safe, and make sure no one tampers with the evidence. Trapped here, without the forensic team, she has only her wits to work with. At first glance, she says to Lachlan, sitting across from her by the fire, none of these murders seems related to one another. The victims didn't know each other until they arrived at this hotel, at least not as far as we know. Maybe something will come to light as we dig deeper. What we don't have right now, she adds, is any kind of motive. Lachlan says, with obvious frustration, I hate sitting here with our feet up and our hands tied. She sighs and says, it's Bradley who's bothering me. She continues to think out loud, but in a lower voice. I knew Bradley. He was always up to something, very enterprising, always had some scheme going. He's involved with this somehow, I'm certain of it. He saw something or knew something, and it got him killed. What did he know?
Up to a bit of blackmail, perhaps? Lachlan suggests.
She looks up at him and nods. That's what I'm thinking. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But who was he blackmailing? Which one of them is our killer? Or do we have more than one? She looks into the fire for a moment and then says, any one of them could have killed Dana. Any one of them could have killed Candace. Any one of them could have killed Bradley, except for Henry and Beverly. They're the only ones who didn't go outside when he was killed.
Yes,
Lachlan agrees. And any of them could have slipped something into Henry Sullivan's drink, for instance, if in fact he was murdered somehow and didn't die of natural causes. They all admit they periodically warmed themselves in front of the fire, and Henry was sitting right there. She adds, not to mention, it sounds like Henry was making himself a bit of a pest with his snooping and his theories, and our killer had to be getting nervous. David aches all over from sitting in the chair with his muscles tensed all night. He longs to go home, but he knows it's going to be a while before any of them can leave. He passes the time watching Gwen, wondering if there is any possible way she might be willing to see him when this is all over, and thinking about who the murderer is. The rest of them seem convinced, or had at least seemed convinced last night, that Ian was the culprit. But he doesn't think so. There is only one person here who knows the truth, he thinks, and that's the killer. And he has a pretty good idea who that is. He just doesn't have any proof, and he doesn't want to share his theory with Sorensen, at least not yet. Gwen desperately wants to know who the killer is. She thinks uneasily about what happened in the early hours of the morning, when Henry had suggested killing Ian. How dangerous people can become when they're scared, she thinks. She's grateful to David for putting a stop to it. Surely, a man who maintains his reason while others around him are losing theirs, surely such a man could never kill his wife or anyone else. She needs to know who the murderer is because she has to know for certain that David didn't do it. Ian paces back and forth in front of the windows of the lobby, ignoring the others as best he can, but he can feel them all watching him. He's glad there's a police officer in the room, watching everybody, protecting him. Even so, he's frightened. He's insisted to all of them that he didn't kill anyone. They don't seem to believe him. What matters is what the police believe. He might need a very good lawyer. He thinks about David Paley, sitting over there with the rest of them. David probably saved his life. Perhaps he will represent him, if it comes to that, if he's arrested. Chapter 35, Sunday, 4:10 p.m. The fire has burned low in the grate, and James arrives in the sitting room to build it up again. Sergeant Sorensen and Officer Lachlan are still in front of the fire when they hear a sound in the distance, the sound of heavy machinery out on the drive.
The road crews must be out,
Lachlan says, standing up eagerly.
Thank God,
Sorensen says with relief, rising from her chair. It won't be long before everybody else gets here then. They leave the sitting room and reach the lobby, where everyone's attention is turned toward the windows. The sound is louder out here. Through the windows, she sees a big yellow snowplow coming slowly and laboriously up the drive. She turns away from the window and looks back at the survivors in the lobby. James has come out of the kitchen at the sound of the plow. The rest remain where they are, as if frozen in place. Sorensen looks at each one of them in turn. James, Beverly, Matthew, Gwen, David, Ian, and Lauren. Sorensen turns back to look out the window. She sees then that there's a truck following behind the snowplow, and she recognizes the crime team. She feels her face break into a relieved smile. Gwen watches as the forensics team disperses and gets to work. Officers Wilcox and Perez remain in the lobby, as if afraid that someone might try to make a run for it. Gwen wonders what the crime team will find. She has spent so much time with these people over this appalling weekend. She has learned their secrets, at least some of them. They have all been scraped raw. And yet, she still feels she knows them hardly at all. She has survived this weekend only to take something ugly away with her. She's learned that you never really know anyone else. That is terrifying, because you can't tell, can you? When she leaves here and goes back out into the world, she will think of everyone she meets as having the potential for evil deep inside. Sergeant Sorensen gets a call saying that the detective has been delayed. For now, she is still in charge. She watches the techs as they work, quickly and efficiently. No matter how careful someone is, she knows, it's very hard these days to get away without leaving a trace of evidence of what they've done. She follows the technicians around the hotel as they put out their careful little markers and take their laborious photographs. She hovers over them while they study the bodies, one after the other, and mutter to each other as they work. It will be a while yet before the bodies can be moved, although they are working as quickly as they can. Now she's outside, watching them pour over the area in the snow where Bradley died. Bright floodlights have been set up in the late afternoon. The effect is almost blinding.
"Looks like he was hit once, on the back of the head,"
one of the techs says.
"The blow was strong enough and heavy enough to kill him."
Now one of the other techs waves her closer.
"Look at this,"
he says. She looks closely as he bends over and points at something in the snow, but she can't see anything. She adjusts her glasses upward a bit to get the full effect of her trifocals.
"I don't see anything," she says.
The tech bends forward again and, using a pair of tweezers, removes something tiny from deeper in the snow and holds it up for her. It's a small diamond earring. No wonder she couldn't see it. "Are you telling me that that was underneath the body?" she says.
The technician nods. "It was frozen into the snow, so it can't have been here long. Only since the snowfall Friday night. And it's a pierced earring. Ought to be able to get some satisfactory DNA off of that."
"So it's a woman," Sorensen says, unable to hide her surprise.
"Looks like it. Good work."
Back inside, Sorensen asks Ian Beaton to come with her into the dining room to answer some more questions. She doesn't look at him when she asks for him. She notices the others stir in expectation. Ian, pale and shaken, lurches his way into the dining room. She asks him to sit, reminds him that he is still under caution, and he drops as if his knees have buckled beneath him.
"I've got a couple of more questions for you, Ian," she says.
He looks at her, his eyes wide with fear. She holds up a little clear plastic evidence bag and places it on the white linen of the dining table. "Have you ever seen this earring before?" He looks down at it, as if stricken dumb. Whatever he was expecting, it obviously wasn't this. "Do you recognize it?" she asks. He nods slowly.
"It's Lauren's. I mean, it looks like the ones she was wearing."
"When was the last time you saw her wearing it?" He sits back in his chair, aware now of what is being asked of him.
"Where did you find it?"
She doesn't answer. She waits.
"She was wearing that pair yesterday, I think."
"You think?"
"She was wearing them yesterday."
"Okay." Sorensen made a point of noticing when she came through the lobby that Lauren isn't wearing any earrings now. But Beverly and Gwen both are. She knows that none of them would have had the opportunity to go back up to their rooms to get another pair if they'd lost one. "Did you happen to notice when she stopped wearing them?" He shakes his head and whispers,
"No."
They all watch warily as Sergeant Sorensen returns to the lobby. They've been on tenterhooks since Ian returned, white and silent, to the lobby and sat down, clearly shaken. Lachlan stands beside Sorensen, ready with a pair of handcuffs. David notices how still everyone is, how alert. He feels his heartbeat escalate as they come to stand in front of Lauren. "Please stand," the sergeant says to Lauren. Lauren rises, visibly trembling. The sergeant says in a firm voice, "Lauren Day, you are under arrest for the murder of Bradley Harwood." David tunes out the rest. As they read Lauren her Miranda rights, he's watching her. She opens her mouth to protest, but it looks as if she can barely breathe. She throws a panicked glance at Ian, but he's unresponsive. He seems too shocked to react. Then Lauren turns to David, her eyes full of panic. She needs someone in her corner. She needs an attorney. But when she looks at him, he meets her eyes only briefly, then turns away. He sees the others' faces, stunned at the turn of events. When Ian hears the handcuffs click as they lock around Lauren's wrists, he feels physically sick. This can't be right, Ian thinks, his heart pounding in his chest. He can't believe it. This can't be happening. He runs his hands agitatedly through his hair. She seems so normal. He thought it was Matthew who had killed everyone, born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Maybe he'd killed his fiancée after an argument and then tried to cover it up with the natural arrogance of the born rich. Maybe Candace and Bradley knew something and he'd had to keep them quiet. But it hadn't been Matthew at all. Matthew is a victim. He has lost the woman he loves. Ian looks at him now and feels terrible for him. He will never be the same. Ian will never be the same either. None of them will ever be the same. He has a sudden bout of dizziness, fights another wave of nausea. Maybe the police have made a mistake. Surely Lauren did not kill all these people. What possible reason could she have? He looks at her again, her lips now pressed in a tight line, her eyes closed. And suddenly, he knows it's true. He can't stop staring at her, wondering what's going on behind those closed eyelids. He realizes that he does not know her at all. He tells himself that he has made a very narrow escape. He shudders. They have spent months together. He thought he was falling in love with her. Matthew watches the police arrest Lauren. He doesn't know what evidence they have, but he trusts the police. They must have good reason for arresting her. He is filled with inexpressible grief and rage, but also relief. Relief that he is no longer suspected of killing his fiancée. He takes one instinctive step toward Lauren and stops. She's the one who murdered Dana. It was her. He can hardly believe it. She's the one who pushed Dana down the stairs and hit her head at the bottom to make sure she was dead. And then, for a time, she allowed everyone to believe that he had probably done it. He'd almost wanted to kill himself out of despair and fear. "Why did you kill her?" he demands, his voice loud with anguish. "Please step back, sir," the sergeant says. Lauren's eyes fly open, and she looks back at Matthew with desperation. "I didn't kill her," she cries. "I didn't kill anyone. They've got it wrong. This is all a mistake. It wasn't me." She turns frantically to Ian. Surely he will help her. "Ian, tell them. Tell them it's not me." But he looks back at her strangely, as if he's afraid of her. What did he say to the police just a few minutes ago when he was in the dining room? What does he know? He can't know anything. David steps forward and cautions her. "Don't say anything. Not a word." Chapter 36. Sunday, 5:45 p.m. Lauren looks into David's eyes, and they aren't the eyes of someone who believes her, someone who will protect her. She collapses to the floor, handcuffed, and closes her eyes again. They let her stay there on the floor, leaning against the sofa. She hears them talking in low voices in the background. She's not going to tell them anything. She has the right to remain silent, and she's going to use it. When Ian invited her up here for a naughty weekend, she had no idea what was going to happen. None of it was planned. She thinks back to that first night. She'd taken a dislike to Dana right from the start. She thought it was because she reminded her of someone, but she couldn't think who. It wasn't until after cocktails, when they were having dinner, that she realized who Dana reminded her of. It wasn't until Dana's comment, "It sounds like someone fell off the roof," and her laughing about it, that she realized exactly who Dana was. And then Lauren's heart began to pound, and she could feel herself turning hot and cold and breaking into a sweat. Dana, she had been Danny when Lauren knew her, had given no sign of recognizing her,
Not until that comment. Then she knew for certain that Danny had recognized her, but had pretended not to. Danny always was a good actor, but Danny obviously wanted Lauren to know that she knew who Lauren was. They'd both changed, at least on the outside. It was a long time ago, 15 years, half her lifetime. Lauren had been a plain, sullen, overweight teen then, and Danny had taunted her relentlessly, but she had recognized her. Danny looked different now, too. At 15, she'd worn her hair very short. She had a tough, mean look. She was a tough, mean girl. Now, 15 years later, she was completely different. This new version, Dana, was very feminine, polished, expensive-looking. No wonder Lauren hadn't recognized her at first. But Lauren was certain that the scrappy Danny was still there. Dana was a fake. Dana didn't look like she'd ever spent a single night in a miserable group home, taking her frustration, rage, and fear out on others more vulnerable than she. Lauren, too, had put her past behind her. She didn't want it to come out now. She had Ian now. She couldn't let Dana ruin everything. She had to be sure that Dana wouldn't say anything. For the rest of the evening, her mind was in turmoil. She let Ian fuck her in the back staircase, but her mind was on other things. Would Dana tell? She told herself that Dana also had a lot to lose. She was about to marry, and obviously into money. Lauren was certain Matthew didn't know about Dana's past. Dana would keep that from him, surely. She wouldn't want a man like Matthew to know what she'd come from. But Dana knew something about Lauren that Lauren couldn't allow to get out. Of all the shitty luck. How easily it all came back to her that night. That horrible time in her life. She was full of rage. She'd been removed from her family's house and sent to that wretched group home on the other side of the city. Her parents had found her unmanageable, and she thought they wanted to teach her a lesson. She hated them for it. Her father had had enough of her, but her mother thought Lauren was just unhappy. Her poor, long-suffering mother. She never really understood who Lauren was. The group home was awful. She didn't even have her own bedroom, but had to share with two other girls. One of them was Danny, tall and skinny and vicious. She never knew what Danny's deal was. They never talked about home and how they ended up in that shithole. The bathroom was shared among six of them. No one ever seemed to clean it. The food was barely edible, but she ate it anyway and hated herself for shoveling it in, looking for comfort wherever she could find it. They would go up onto the roof. It seems unlikely now. Unbelievable that when they were in care, they would climb up the TV antenna tower in the backyard and get onto the roof. The house was at the end of the street, and if they stayed on the back of the roof, no one saw them. They would hang out up there, smoking cigarettes that Danny stole from Mrs. Purcell, the woman who was supposed to be looking after them. One afternoon, one of the kids, Lucas, he was 13 but seemed younger, climbed up after them and asked Danny for a smoke. Danny told him to fuck off. He stayed. He kept pestering them until Danny told him his parents were drug addicts and they were never coming back for him because she'd heard the social worker telling Mrs. Purcell that they'd overdosed and he was an orphan now. She really could be a cold-hearted bitch. "You're lying," he shouted, furious tears streaming down his face. "I'm going to tell on you." "Go ahead," Danny said, flicking her cigarette ash. Then she added, "God, you're such a baby." Getting nowhere with Danny and stinging with hurt and the need to hurt someone else, Lucas turned on Lauren and said, with a contempt beyond his years, "You're fat and ugly." And Lauren stood up suddenly and pushed him off the roof, just like that. Danny turned to her in shock. "Jesus, do you know what you just did?"
They looked down at the boy on the patio stones below. He wasn't moving. His head was split.